While I'm doing that, you know what? I do have one more thing. On July 1st through 8th, 2017, there's going to be an Alaska Cruise Conference. And the Reasons to Believe scholars are going to be talking. That'll be part of what they're doing on the conference. And they'll also be leading an expedition. But these pamphlets here express what they're going to be talking about, and how much it costs, how much the staterooms are, et cetera, and what the discussions will be about. I'm going to put these on the piano. No hard sell. If you want to look at them, please do. If you don't, you know what to leave alone. Ross, are you done feeding yet, or are you still trying to figure it out? Thanks. So the answer, I guess, means is no?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right. Yes, please.
Did you send out an email for this meeting?
Yes.
How long ago?
Several weeks ago. Yeah, and if you know somebody, feel free to let them know. When I send out the emails, I have my email address on there, so you can reply directly to me if you want somebody else to know. With that, you ready, Russ?
Finally.
Really?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay.
In my mouth.
All right. Then I'm going to put some in mine. All right. With that, Russ, please take over. Thank you.
Thank you.
Does this thing, can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. You can hear me without that. Good. Good evening, everybody. I read a lot. Most of you who know me know that. And one of the most recent books that I read, I saw it at Barnes & Noble, and I said, I want to read that. It's called Talking God, Philosophers on Belief by a guy named Gary Gutting. Does that sound okay? I sound like I'm in a cave. Is it all right? Does it sound all right to you guys? Yeah, all right, all right. So Gary Gutting is a philosophy, endowed chair in philosophy at the University of Notre Dame, and he is a self-professed Catholic and agnostic. Okay? His position is that agnosticism is the only rational position to take when it comes to does God exist? He doesn't believe that atheism is a rational position, and he certainly doesn't believe that theism is a rational position. So, but he's actually of a good heart. He's not one of those new atheist kind of guys like Dawkins who just wants to bash religion. He really seems like he's open and wants to discuss it. What he's done is he has, each chapter in the book is an interview that he did with a person from many different faith traditions. So he started with Alvin Plantinga, who's a Christian, and he interviewed a Hindu and a Buddhist and a Muslim and a Jew and a couple of different categories of atheists and a couple of scientists. And he wanted to find out what their perception of God was and how they felt about, does God exist? It's a really good book. If you want to know how people see God from different position, different faiths, it's a good introduction. And I was reading this and I was talking to Mark about it because I have lunch with him all the time. He said, why don't you teach it? I said, okay, be good. So what I've done is I've come up with six or seven of the arguments that he or his interviewees have made in the book. And what I want to do is read a section of the book. I have a slide that sort of sums up the argument. And then just open it up to the audience, to you guys, to discuss it. What do you think of that? As Christians, we are instructed to share our faith. Couple of reasons we do that. Jesus commanded it, and we believe it is true, but we also believe that our faith is supposed to make a difference in our life, in the way that we live. And I think that my own story is I started out on an intellectual pursuit of who God is. Is he the God of the Bible? And that was an introduction to being able to open my heart to the more holistic side of the faith. My own personal experience is that I am not a really terrific, wonderful person by nature. And, yes, but my relationship with Jesus Christ has started a transformation in me that I cannot explain outside of my faith. And to me, that's the most compelling reason that I'm a Christian. I also had a physical miracle happen to me. So that's pretty convincing. So I am passionate about this, and yet, as believers, we, as Christians, we are supposed to share our faith in a loving, hospitable, humble way. And I'm hoping that's the way it comes across. So let's start with the first argument. I call this argument a variety of doctrines. And I'm going to read a couple of paragraphs. And for those of you who haven't been here before, I really like to have an open forum. I really want the discussion. I want you guys to talk more than I talk. So let's read a couple of paragraphs. And you guys, if you are a believer, how would you respond to someone who gave you this argument? If you are not a believer and you like the argument, then you can support it. Here we go. Accepting the core teachings of one religion requires denying at least some core teachings of others. Such denials would make sense for believers who could make a strong rational case for the specific core beliefs of their religion. If you have a solid case for believing that God is triune, for example, you have good reason to reject the views of Jews and Muslims. But few believers can make such a case. Their commitment is typically a matter of firm conviction, which he calls faith, produced by their religious training and practice. As Kitcher notes, Kitcher is one of his interviewees, a firm conviction based on religious training and practice is also what believers in other religions have. If, therefore, Christians reject Muslim beliefs, they must claim that Muslims' education and training did not provide good reasons for believing in Islam, but merely applied social and psychological techniques that produce those beliefs, regardless of whether they were true. They offer a naturalistic explanation of their beliefs, but Christians have no answer to Muslims who make the same criticism of Christian beliefs. Kitcher's conclusion is that no theistic religion can consistently support the claim that rival views are false and that its views are true. So I sum that up by saying all faiths have a variety of conflicting doctrines, none of which can be rationally supported, therefore they all must be rejected. How would you answer that? George?
I have a question.
Yeah.
When you say all faiths have a variety of conflicting doctrines, are you talking about within their own faith? Or?
Yes, for example, the one he brought up about Christians believe God is triune, Muslims and Jews believe God is... No, what I meant was all faiths have a variety of conflicting doctrines when compared to other faiths. Yeah.
Well, I would, if someone was concerned about this, tell them that one of the key means to assess the validity of a belief system is to determine whether the documents that promulgate historically accurate, that in the case of Christianity, whether the question of whether a first century rabbi in Jerusalem who claimed to be divine was executed as a criminal and then later stood up and was seen alive by hundreds of people, whether that was a real event or whether that was some vast conspiracy that was generated century by somehow people believing things to the extent that they lost their lives by maintaining their beliefs, and in other words, when challenged and persecuted, insisted that what they said was true, and also that that particular belief system that we call Christianity propagated very widely in one must explain how that was. Why was it accepted so pervasively, in spite of the fact that most of the government at the time that was controlled from Rome was extremely averse to the people that advanced the beliefs. And then the other thing I would point out is that in investigating or evaluating any belief of the supernatural, that in this era that we have science which indicates that in the last 50 years that the universe is not eternal, that it had a beginning, and the cosmologists are in general agreement that whatever it was that caused the inception of the universe, it was something which transcends space-time and also involved, well, from the other investigations showing that there's a very precise design, and that it implies that there was an intelligent agent, especially for life forms. That's the only credible or at all reasonable premise, that there was an intelligent agent that caused the inception of life forms. Even Stephen Gould, the Ulster Boy for Evolution in a Cancun Origin of Life conference about 20 years ago, resorted to explaining life origins by a panspermia, that some distant civilization in the star system far, far away once upon a time sent a little capsule of biotic material to target the Earth, and that's the best he could do to answer the papers that were given at that conference. It just utterly defeated all the mechanistic ideas explaining the origin of life. So in other words, that at least someone should be aware that there is strong evidence for a transcendent, supernatural intelligent being. And the question is, what best represents the nature of that being, and what is the evidence basis? And the resurrection account is probably the best evidence that would be available now to determine whether that somehow was construed as some monstrous legend that was just totally false, and then deluded millions of people at the time. And how that could be, that's otherwise as it's represented to be.
Thank you, John. Mark.
All the truthful what you're saying in so far that describing that you have this multitude of religions which do conflict fundamentally, and you identified some of the fundamental conflicts with the nature of God.
Mm-hmm.
So he's right. You know, you have a variety of faiths, and so at least that far, either one of them is correct, the rest are wrong. All of them are incorrect. And so the next step he makes is the one that I was going to ask you about, which is where he says, none of which can be rationally supported. Did he give any evidence about what, first of all, what does he mean by rational support? How is he defining rational support?
Yeah, he doesn't really, in the book, he doesn't go into that. He just makes that, the Kitcher, who is the person he's interviewing in this chapter, does not really go into why he believes it is not rationally testable.
Okay, so here's what I would say. I mean, this is not an uncommon objection. And one of the problems that we have with objections like this is the definition of what is the standard of evidence. So you can't have a proof like a mathematical. That's not going to work. On the other hand, you can't make just, I believe it's true, to be the standard of evidence, because then all of them are the same.
That's right.
Yeah. So there has to be something that amounts to either beyond reason or doubt, or clear and convincing evidence, or I'm borrowing from law. But
or piling up of evidence.
An accumulation of evidence, but even that's you're going to have to say, well, how much of that is going to amount to what you count as sufficient. So what counts as sufficient evidence, and what counts as evidence? He doesn't say that here, and that's a problem we have with the rationality and carefully diminished without being overwhelmed with cognitive biases and being able to support it with evidence that everyone could examine objectively in the
Yes.
I think that would be rational. And I think there are some tests to it. That Christianity in particular can be rationally supported from an evidentiary position.
I think John brought that up when he talked about the historical evidence.
Yeah, there's a lot, and we don't have time to get into that. But my point is that this is the issue at bar right now. What is our response to this claim?
That's right.
And my response to it is, to be better defined, at least when it comes to rational support, and that he's in part right. You can't have all of these religions being true because they do conflict fundamentally.
But is it rational to say because this very important subject has so many conflicting claims among so many religions, we just have to reject them all?
No.
No, it's not.
I think he's on the rejecting because of the rational thing. Because the other one, yeah, one.
Yeah. Helen.
I got this from Ken Sample's book, that Christianity has, and maybe John said some of this, I couldn't hear everything you said, but Christianity has a lot of historical evidence, and Christ was born during the time of the Romans, and there's a lot of written history, and because of his resurrection, history is divided into two sections, before Christ and A.D. after, not his is ante something.
On Anno Domini?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, Ken Sample's book says that the history of the Hindu god and the different other religions like that, a lot of it is just hearsay, and there's not a lot of historical documentation. So I think as a Christian, we have a lot more to back up what we believe in, just historically.
You know, it's interesting because the Apostle Paul says, what does he say about the resurrection?
If it didn't exist, we might as well.
If the resurrection didn't happen, physically happen, not as a metaphor for something or a story, if it didn't actually happen, then all of our faith is null and void and we're worse off than people who don't believe. So there's an actual test for Christianity. There it is. If you could prove that the resurrection of Jesus Christ didn't happen, we're all wasting our time. Is that true for any other faith that you can think of? Is there a singular statement in their creed or doctrine that says, show me this, and you've disproved the entire faith? That's a remarkable statement. Now, how would you all respond to somebody who says, Jamie?
It also said it very early when it could have been tested.
Yes, that's right. He says he said that very early when it could have been tested, the resurrection. So how would you respond to somebody who just says, you're right, the evidence for the resurrection is really compelling, and I can't explain the origin of life, and the origin of the universe seems really amazing, but I just don't believe in miracles. I have never seen the laws of nature broken. That they are inviolable. This is how the universe works. If we can't explain the resurrection in any other way, it doesn't mean it actually happened. It just means we haven't figured it out yet. How do you respond to that? With a phone call. Yeah, he's getting the answer, right? He's asking Siri. Sure. Anybody want to answer that? Josephus was one.
Well,
Tacitus? Yeah, Josephus was an early Roman historian.
Jewish.
Jewish, sorry, yes. Yeah. And he refers to the resurrection.
He was in one place, but he lived. He was born 30 years later.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
So he's referring to historical documents as well.
Well, at 30 years, I would think that there would still be a lot of people talking about it if it had happened. There's a scholar named Gary Habermas who has kind of made it his life to study the resurrection. And he has a very interesting argument. What he's done, and he's got several books on this, but what he's done is he's taken six or seven of the minimal facts about the resurrection, the facts that are accepted by basically every scholar, whether they're a believer or an unbeliever. And he argues for the resurrection from those minimal facts and says it's the only event that could explain the facts that everyone agrees with. So you look like you're going to say something. Okay. So one of the ways I think about it is it comes from one of Paul's writings where he in 1 Corinthians he claims, which was written about 15 or 20 years after Jesus was on earth, and he claims that there were 500 people still alive that saw Jesus resurrected, saw him bodily after the resurrection. And there's no documents anywhere, there's nothing that ever refutes that. Now, I would think that if that were not true, somebody, Josephus or Pliny or one of those guys writing at those times would have said, this is false, don't buy this. But there's no documentation at all. There's nothing that says that's not true. And so Paul was putting his livelihood on the line by saying that. He was saying, there's people alive right now while I'm writing this that were witness to Jesus' resurrected body. Anyone at the time could have come to him and said, you're out of your mind, you're nuts, what are you talking about? So that's a piece, it's biblical, but it's sort of extra biblical as well. Jamie? You got to speak up a little.
If the Pharisees and the Jewish rulers wanted to refute it, they could have just dragged out the body of Jesus and showed everybody.
That's one of the facts that Gary Habermas talks about.
Could you repeat that? I couldn't hear it again.
If the Jewish authorities wanted to, Gary Habermas also narrows down the 1 Corinthians 15, 3 through 5 section as a very early
creed,
which could have been as early as 5 years after or even 6 months after. They don't know, but it's pretty soon. Anyway, what I said was that the Jewish authorities, if they wanted to absolutely refute the resurrection at that time, they could have just dragged out the body of Jesus because everybody knew where he was buried.
There are a lot of people at the time that would have been very interested in seeing the dead body. And
it would have been very easy for them. Well, what did they say? They said the disciples stole it.
Yeah.
Which kind of tells you that the tomb was empty as well.
Right, it's an admission that the tomb was empty. And separate.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So there is a certain degree of artificiality in referring to the Bible as unity. fragmentary descriptions of events from different people. Could we not say that these are different accounts that we should be listening to? You don't have to accept them, but why are they there and what did they lead to? So first of all, to say, well, you know, outside the Bible, well, let's look at inside the Bible as you look at the Bible a different way. Look at the Bible as a collection of accounts by different people, any one of whom could have disproved the others. And when you look at those accounts, they're not all identical. It isn't as if they all sat down together and said, hey, dude, let's scribble out a book and make some money on this. Not that at all. Part of why so many people accept the Bible is that you have these disparate accounts that are complementary but not identical, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
They really were a conspiracy of this cult called Christians that formed. Why would they not have been more similar as other cults were that did try to do that? That by itself is a very interesting phenomenon.
Well, in your police work, Mark, when you had, say, three eyewitnesses of a particular event, how did those eyewitnesses differ?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you have three people who saw a shooting or stabbing or some kind of traumatic event, they would typically have the core similar. So, I saw a knife, saw it get stuck in them, I'm not sure what he had in left. That core part would be there. But the rest of the facts would be distorted, and I shouldn't say distorted, but be different, because they're looking at a different perspective, and memory doesn't always work that way. That would be a little bit different, though, in the biblical tradition, though, because in the biblical times, the ability to pass on information verbally was extremely prized. People today don't appreciate that.
And practiced.
And practiced, yes. So you have to actually look at history, not just Christian history, but history in general of how things were passed down. And in the Jewish tradition, it was extremely, to the extreme, where you went to school to memorize. And you were taught to memorize. Memorization was a big deal. So the argument that, well, some of these were written 10 years or 15 years after the fact. Okay, so what if I wrote a book today from something that happened 15 years ago that I actually saw happen? It was something as startling as a dude getting out of the crypt.
Like somebody that went through 9/11.
Yeah. And others who saw the same thing at different times. The stories are not identical. When you look at the Gospels, they're not identical. You can see some differences in them, which suggest that they aren't collusion or conspiratorial. So I guess I wanted to emphasize that because it is very, it's important to understand the nature of the Bible and the nature of the collection of books of different people.
Good. Thank you, Mark. Dave?
This is a really great conversation. One of the things that just woke to my mind, I have non-Christian friends that I've been sharing my faith with for a long time, and seeing this rationally supported and talking about it made me realize, obviously, that it's interesting that these people will put different levels of support that you have to have. So I have friends that believe in aliens, and even though there is absolutely no rational support for that at all, but no matter how much rational support I give them for Christianity, they discount it, obviously. So it's a great one. I go back to this. I'm going to try and get them to see if they can recognize their own inconsistency, that for Christianity, the standard is way high, and I can never produce enough information, and yet they release aliens, and there is absolutely no support for it other than the last Hollywood movie he saw. You know?
Yeah.
And,
well,
and so it's very interesting. So I think there's something with the will and that heart and the heart where, okay, for Christ, you know, the standard has got to be 100%, but for aliens, you know, it's 0.002 is fine, you know.
Okay. Well, I'm going to challenge. If you don't mind, I'm going to challenge you. I'm going to play the atheist or the agnostic for a minute. I would say the importance of the question whether there are aliens is way less than, is there a God who cares about me and depending on what I do on this planet, determines where I go for eternity. So the standard of proof for that question has got to be higher. And if it is, why hasn't God given us more clear, concise proof, evidence? Why is it so mushy? Why is it slipped through our fingers so easily when we try to figure out? Or does it?
Yeah, what's interesting is a lot of these friends, obviously, is because Hollywood has made the aliens so dark now. I have friends who are seriously afraid of aliens, think that, you know, it's going to come and they're going to be terrified. You know, this is an adult. And then I'm talking to their kids have adopted this fear, you know. You know, when I talk to family and say it's an irrational fear, you know, there's much more bigger things to be afraid of than aliens, you know, to occupy your time. You know, you ought to, and this is what we have phrased it next, is say, you know, the judgment day of God is coming, and you're less afraid of the judgment day of God and more afraid of aliens. You know, have you got your priorities straight? You know, and that's just this discussion has just made that discourse of their fear and the rational of how much evidence they need to have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good because it's just a new place to take the conversation, because the conversation hasn't moved recently other than this is, you know, telling your kid that you're afraid of aliens is a waste of time, because, you know, it's not going to happen. It hasn't happened in the past. It's not going to happen in the future. There's no evidence there. You know?
Our belief in aliens is based on the latest movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's scary. Does anybody have an answer to that, though? Why is, if the burden of proof is higher, yes.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But okay, but go ahead.
I just want to respond to the alien.
Yeah.
I almost feel like in individuals, we have the desire to not be alone.
Yeah.
On this planet. We realize we're a tiny little speck in the universe and the galaxies. And, I think that we realize there is something more out there. And some people say aliens.
If you don't mind...
Even angels and, you know, different realms.
I'd like to offer a personal response to that.
Okay.
I see the desire, that longing that we feel... that we're not alone, that we don't be alone. I think it's the same thing we feel late at night when we're in bed, we're in our own thoughts, and we're lonely and lost and feeling disconnected. I think it's that same thing. To me, the fact that those feelings exist is evidence for a God that cares about us. Think about it. My cat doesn't feel those things. He just goes, he eats. Sleeps, he cries, and he's very, you know, as long as he's fed, he's very much at peace.
Our dog feels those things.
Well, that's because to him, you're God. So if evolution is true, and you know, the theory of evolution tells us that there's nothing about us that wasn't added unless it was needed. It's very careful. How can you explain that need? I see it as something that God built into us, and that desire is basically for Him. Everybody feels it, and that's, I can't explain it any other way. I can't explain it from an evolutionary standpoint. I see the appreciation of beauty as the same way. What a complete waste of time that is from an evolutionary standpoint. Yet there it is, this amazing thing that's built into our brain that has all this extra software that's required and all this energy that goes into that that doesn't do anything for our survival or... Ted?
So a fellow that I argue with would respond to that and say, oh, well, that's just a utilitarian. It enhances your the survivability of your community, of your society, because it makes you a social animal. It means that you're like a wolf pack or whatever, that you support one another, you seek one another's company, you seek one another's support. You look at a herd of elephants. Why do elephants weep when one of their herd dies? Well, they're social animals. They stick together, they keep the predators away and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. It's utilitarian. That would be the response I'd get from an atheist.
Yes, but the elephants never get together on Sunday and pray, no matter how much you, how smart the dolphins and gorillas and the apes are. I mean, you have gorillas with vocabulary of 400 or 500 words, and they're smarter than some of the people, you know, who have mental disabilities. And yet, I've seen children with mental disabilities and have an IQ lower than a gorilla find joy in worshiping God, where they cannot get these gorillas and dolphins together on Sunday to pray and worship.
I would say that's possibly true, but it's a whole lot more than we need from a stingy evolutionary standpoint to propagate the species. Yes.
Because the way you're describing it is that you're using a frame or a way of describing it that suggests that because this creates a better environment, that it necessarily, that evolution necessarily produced it. As if evolution could anticipate that this was needed. So the question is this going to be an accident? Or could it have occurred accidentally? Presumes that the mind and the brain are identical, and that what we find in the human mind, which is the acknowledgement of beauty, the ability to communicate symbolically, which is unique, that these are strictly functions that are natural,
yeah.
That come from chemicals,
mm-hmm.
And that mutations we create them. Yet there's no evidence that that has occurred. There's no evidence, we have no evidence that there's any mutation that will create a mind that appreciates beauty. And so when we're talking about evolution, we need to be able to be sure that we're going to pin down anybody who's going to claim this. We're going to pin down and say, that's fine if you want to claim that, but please give me some physical evidence, because you're claiming that evolution is all about physical evidence. Where's the physical evidence? What mutation does it take to make that happen? I can show you the mutation it takes to create a spine. I can show you the mutation it takes to create all the other things. But what mutation could it possibly do in an orangutan's DNA that would suddenly make it, that would turn on the capacity to convey beauty, create beauty, or argue symbolically?
Or create some higher math is the other one.
Yeah, I mean, language. You know, language, one thing is to tell me, to say, you know, grunt and make things happen. But it's a completely different thing to write poetry. There's something that goes on in poetry that's uniquely human, intrinsically human, and exclusively human. Where does that come from?
And it isn't a jump from the animals. It's a different thing in kind.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of scientists are trying to find that out. It's the same people who are trying to find out what Francis Crick was trying to find at Caltech when he was in this study called the Neuronal Correlates of Consciousness. But Francis Crick was the co-discoverer of DNA. And Francis Crick went to Caltech, and it was probably about a decade ago. And he says, well, I'm going to get a bunch of scientists together, and we're going to do our best to see where in the brain does consciousness reside. Before he died, he said, when asked, where do you think it is? And do you think we'll ever find it? He said, I don't think we will ever find the neuronal correlates of consciousness. By the way, this is the same man who said what you across the room there attributed to Stephen Jay Gould, the late Stephen Jay Gould. It was Francis Crick who said, as a chemist, mind you, a chemist, who said, there is no way chemistry of the earth put the information together to create DNA, far less to create the chemistry to make DNA. It had to have come from outside our mind. Mm-hmm. Francis Crick said that. So he did not have much belief. And he was not a Christian, he was not a theist. He
had no religious beliefs, except that he didn't believe in religion. But here's a man who's saying, we're stuck. Scientifically, we're stuck. Could a scientist rationally say, well, we'll discover this in the future? Yes, you could. You could. But there's also a problem of accumulation of, well, this isn't, we're bumping into dead ends. If you bump in enough dead ends, you're going to be in a crisis.
Which is why they have the theory now that there's this unknown force in nature they haven't discovered. That's the new phrase.
Yeah. And that's, of course, they have to bump in it. If Christianity were true, that's what you would predict. And Christianity does have a predictive model. And it's uniquely a miracle.
I think you touched on something. Thank you for that, Mark. You touched on something that is one of the most compelling lines of argument for me is you think about information, you think about the written pages in this book, you think about the information in your computer, what I'm saying right now, all the different forms there are of information. There are no examples anywhere ever where the source of the information created itself. Now you can say computers create information and they talk to other computers, but if you take the string far enough back, the original computer was input, was programmed with information from a human being. There's as much information in the DNA in the most basic bacteria, which we think is what the first organisms looked like. There's as much information in that DNA as there is in about a 300-page book. For the most part, it has to be in a particular order, just like a language. Now, by analogy, if we can't know, we can't find any sources of information other that didn't come from a mind, doesn't it make sense that the original information that went into the very first living organism, which was insanely complex, came from a mind? It just makes sense. That's right, yeah. We know by stripping the genes and chromosomes out of bacteria that there's a minimal complexity that's required for life to exist. You get past that point, it dies because it can't reproduce, it can't respirate, it can't protect itself, it can't eat, it can't do anything. And that minimal complexity requires an insane amount of information that's coded in a particular way. How did that get... All the arguments about the first life form talk about complexity and these chemicals came together, but nobody talks about the programming. Who programmed that DNA so that it could be alive in the first place? It looks to me like a mind is a better explanation than random natural forces. To me, that's a huge piece of evidence for a creator, for the creator of the Bible. I don't know any living... You know, before life, what do? It's before life, so there wasn't any minds to create it, unless you can posit God.
And the fact that the line used to be, well, we had lots of time, and of course now we know why. As soon as the birth could support life, we have life, and it's zero time.
Right. Yeah, George?
The argument though that the atheists give is that no matter how complex life forms are, if you're going to say they came from God, you have to be even more complex. Where do you come from?
Well, that's a great question. I think I got an answer. Anybody want to try it? Yes, sir.
What's in chapter 2?
Of the book? Yeah, we've been an hour and we're on number 1. John, you want to try to answer that?
Yes. In philosophy, you can make a very good case for the fact that, Albert Einstein pondered this problem of why anything exists at all rather than nothing. And the answer is that in order for anything to exist at all, there must be something which is self-existent, which exists. And that's a category that's beyond our ability to really completely understand or comprehend. But it's just like the cosmologist with the inception of the universe. There was something that... existed that was capable of conception of the universe. And whatever that was, if you go back far enough, it, you can't make an infinite regression. Oh, well, there was something that caused that and caused that. There has to be at some point something which is self-existent, which is, again, a concept that is not something we can easily comprehend. But that's the only way to explain that anything exists at all. So whatever created the universe was a result of something which was self-existent, which, of course, is one of the attributes that's given to the Christian God.
Let me just...
The complexity of anything that matters.
Let me just say this, and then I want to get on because this gentleman's correct. Secular science tells us that time came into existence with the creation of the universe. It's not this ether that everything exists in. It was part of the creation. So if there is a God that is outside of the creation, he not only created matter and space, but time was part of the creation. Now, that's impossible for us to wrap our heads around. We cannot imagine a timeless existence. But you're right. You can't go backwards infinitely with a cause and effect. When you get past time equals zero, you have this self-existent being who has existed eternally. That's the word the Bible uses for a timeless existence. That makes sense now all of a sudden. He doesn't need a cause because cause implies time. There was no time. He simply exists, chose to create. Time was part of the creation.
The same fellow I argue with when I say that, well, okay, that God created everything and God always existed. And he says, oh, you Christians, you are. And I say, so my response, and tell me if this sounds like a persuasive response, is, well, you scientists thought it was just okay to have a always existing universe
eternal
back in 1940. So what happened to your standard of evidence or proof, or what? Why did you change the rules that now that's not okay?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
The original scientists that many in the scientific community, when the Big Bang was first introduced, saw it as a theological statement, because they saw it as a threat because it agreed with Genesis. But there was so much overwhelming evidence after decades and decades that they just had to accept it. Let's do number two. I call this one, God is not necessary. Some religious values are worth preserving, but doctrines about God's existence, nature, and intervention in history are not ultimately necessary to support these values. We should not summarily dispatch religion to the rubbish heap, but we should reduce it to an ethical view that is entirely consonant with what Kitcher calls a fully secular world. So his statement basically is, God is not needed for the development and preservation of good moral values.
3 weeks in the Soviet Union, I saw what a godless society produced, you know, and it was hell, which is why the Soviets voted themselves out of existence. They basically said, we had this godless society, you know, communism, where everything's for the state, and it didn't work, and they voted themselves out of existence.
Okay, but let's say a culture like that perseveres, and they adopt a value that is a biblical value. They adopt it not because it's in the Bible, but because it's functional, it works. So let's say human equality, okay? Do they need God to adopt that value and maintain it?
Well, they have that. If you read the communist, constitution, it claimed equality. It claimed everybody was equal. But because it was for the state and not for God, it didn't work. Nobody had respect for the state because you basically are worshiping system, and so that doesn't work either. Having morals without a God does not work. So we tried that also, and it didn't work.
Jamie, thank you, Dave.
Needed God.
God is not needed to tell us right from wrong.
Do you mean
necessary that they have to believe in God to know what right and wrong is, or does God have to exist for there to be morality in the first place?
I think you guys are tuning me up on my descriptions here. That's good. I think what he's saying is that we don't need a written document supposedly from God that defines morals and moral values for us to find those values and figure them out ourselves, like the Quran or the Bible or whatever. Val?
That's their moral value, stated and restated, even though now, you know, a lot of people say, oh, that's the old Quran, we don't believe that anymore. But the fact is, if you're going to look at a book like that as a source, I mean, that's gone down the wrong road. If you're going to say what's moral and what's not, who makes the decision what's moral and what's not?
That's really an important point. Thank you. Jamie, you had something else to say?
I think the moral argument is an extremely powerful argument.
Argument for the existence of God. Tell me why.
Because you can't ground morality without God, without a moral lawgiver, without somebody. I mean, who's to say human equality is good in the long run if there is no God? If there's no one to ground that proposition. What makes that good? I mean, it's like you say, it's functional, it works, and we like it, but other people might not like it. If you don't have something grounding it, then it seems like you either have what I think is right or what society thinks is right, and that's so subjective it could go in any direction.
Good. Good. Thank you. George.
But the argument against that is your choice of which God is going to use to provide your moral, what your morality is, that's subjective too.
Right. You haven't got to that point yet. You're just seeing that God exists.
That was point one. That was the first chapter. The first chapter are all religions the same? And our conclusion was, no, they're not all the same. That one, you have to have back there before this one.
Yeah. Okay. John?
Well, I guess I would ask the author, how would he know what's good?
Yes.
I keep thinking of what happened to Jean-Paul Sartre, the 20th century French philosopher. Near the end of his life, he worked feverishly trying to devise an ultimate objective value system that could withstand any scrutiny. And so much so that it was probably the approximate cause of his death, because he was just totally absorbed in it. Sometimes 20 hours a day, just with 4 hours sleep, trying to solve this problem. But the thing that he came close to realizing was, in order to know what is the what would be an objective good, there must be an unbounded understanding of the ultimate consequences that extends without any limit. And requires omniscience, to know everything, all possibilities, the logic involved in analyzing all situations, and that eventually he came close to ascribing the requirements for this unassailable moral value system as being in alignment with those of a deity.
Hmm.
There's no, for instance, we can say, in order to make us, we need a strong nation, and what we have to do is get rid of all the useless eaters and defective people, and even like children when they're 10 years old, if they don't measure up to a standard, throw them over a cliff, you know, and stop wasting energy. This could be a good thing. It could be argued that that's a good thing.
Yeah.
And what's been happening in the last many thousands of years is the all of humanity has been experiencing the process of determining our own moral values, which are independent of what was available in the very beginning from a perfect creator. And of course, the best ones are being restored because the revelations from that creator up through history. But the whole problem of evil is because of the strict policy of free will that the creator imparted to human beings. So we are free to make our own mistakes and discover just how utterly insolubly inadequate we are to these tasks. We really, they're far greater than people ordinarily respond.
Thank you, John. I think Jamie got the closest to where I wanted to go with this, and that is that, let's say a culture adopts a biblical principle, it works, and they say, we're just going to stick to this, we don't need God now to maintain this. The problem is, without it being grounded in the transcendent, without us being able to say, God gave this to us for all time, for all cultures, because it works for everyone, it will simply drift away, and something else will be picked up in a generation or two. So there's nothing that makes it stick. I sense a little uneasiness. So let's take 5 minutes and take a break and get some food and get loose. So 5 minutes though, 4:15, let's be ready to go again.